I'd like to speak this evening on the book of Jonah, but before we turn to Jonah, could we look please at 2 Kings chapter 14? And the reason is that I believe it's essential for us to understand the circumstances in which Jonah lived and which prompted the message which he brought. Unfortunately, Jonah is one of those books that we seem to be fairly familiar with, and as with many things that we're very familiar with, we don't quite get the message that was intended. We get all taken up with the story of the big fish and the big swallowing up and then the regurgitating, and sometimes we miss the real thrust of the story, which in fact is found in the final chapter. The whole purpose of the story of Jonah is given to us in the very last couple of verses. But to get the full meaning of it, I think we have to go back to 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 25. And it tells us that Jonah lived in a time which led up to an era of great prosperity under the king of Israel, Jeroboam II. If I can go back just a little before chapter 14, we'll find that Israel was attacked on every side by the Syrians, and the Syrians wrought tremendous havoc right through the nation, left it on its knees, so to speak. But the Syrians eventually lost their power. I beg your pardon, the Syrians, not the Assyrians. The Syrians eventually lost their power, and as they declined, so Israel was able to stabilize itself once again. And because they were not interfered with by people from outside, they managed to rehabilitate themselves and attain a fairly large degree of prosperity. Also, they were able to expand their borders. And if you put the northern part Israel and the southern part Judah together, you'll find that the area that they occupied was an area greater than any that the nation had occupied since the golden days of David and Solomon. Now, this expansion, this growth, this national prosperity had been foreseen by the prophet Jonah. And in 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 25, it tells us that the king, Jeroboam II, restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath, that is in the far north, up in the area of Phoenicia and Syria, right from the far north as far as the Sea of the Arabah, which is the Dead Sea, which was the border between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And all of this happened according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was from Gath-Hepha. Jonah was the one who foresaw this expansion, and it's all involved with the message which later on he had to bring to the people of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. Can you turn now please to the book of Jonah? I mentioned that Israel enjoyed a degree of prosperity and peace, and during this lull in external activities, the nation was able to grow and prosper. But there was one dark cloud on the horizon, and that dark cloud was the nation Assyria. Assyria, not to be confused with Syria that I mentioned earlier. The capital of Assyria was Nineveh. Assyria was the up-and-coming power in the region, and already it had spread its tentacles out and taken over a few of the other countries. And it wouldn't be long before it would be turning its attention towards the land of Israel. However, the capital of Assyria, Nineveh, was under threat by an enemy which was going to attack from the north. God wanted to preserve Assyria from attack, and therefore he said to his prophet Jonah, I want you to go to Nineveh and to warn those people that there's a coming judgment, and within 6 weeks the nation is going to fall unless they repent of their evil and turn to me. And we know that Jonah didn't want to go. In fact, he didn't go. He turned and went the opposite direction, and he had various adventures that we're familiar with. Swallowed by a great fish, and eventually spewed up onto the land again. And having learnt his lesson the hard way, the second time God's word came to him, and this time he went. Now, if we look at the book of Jonah, you find that the very first verse tells us that this man Jonah is the same man that's referred to in the verses we read in 2 Kings chapter 14. In verse 1, he is the son of Amittai, and he is the prophet to whom God said, go and take my message to Nineveh. We won't read through chapter 1 because I think you know the story very well. The last verse of chapter 1 tells us that the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. And then in chapter 2, we find that Jonah prayed to the Lord from inside the fish. It's unfortunate that so often people's consideration of the book of Jonah seems to center around whether a fish could swallow a man. And everyone gets sidetracked onto this issue. It's not the real issue of the book at all. And I would imagine it's been demonstrated time and again that it's quite possible for a great fish to swallow a man and to get rid of him again. That's not really the point of the story. If you're looking for a miracle in the story, of course, it's the fact that this particular fish happened to be in that particular part of the sea, and it happened to swallow Jonah just when he got thrown over, and it also got rid of him at a place where he landed on dry land. God was over all. And you're certainly seeing in the book of Jonah how that God not only controls the international events, God also controls other events. He controls all events. And the lesson here is one of God's sovereignty in directing all things according to his purposes, even the adventures of Jonah. And chapter 2 is not a prayer of Jonah for God to save Jonah. Rather, it's a prayer of thanksgiving to God because God has already saved Jonah. He was thrown into the sea and he was going down, and then he cried out to God and God saved him. And when he woke up and realized that he was still alive, he then burst forth with this prayer, which has been recorded here, which is a prayer of thanksgiving for the salvation which he has already experienced in being saved from drowning, and which to him is a guarantee of the fact that his ultimate salvation is assured. And he recalls then, in this prayer in chapter 2, he recalls how, in verse 2, how when he was going down through the water, he cried to the Lord in his distress, and the Lord answered him. And as he was descending into the place of death, it seemed, out of there God heard his voice and saved him. He mentions in verse 3 that he was cast into the waters, into the deep, into the heart of the sea, and all the floods were round about him, the waves were going over him, and his end looked to be in sight. Because he said in verse 4, I'm cast out from thy presence, and how again shall I look upon thy holy temple? He realized that this was it, his number was up, and he didn't seem to have much more opportunity now of going to God's temple to worship, particularly when actually he was heading towards the ocean's bottom. The waters closed over him, and in verse 5 we find the reeds were all wrapped around his head. And he went down in verse 6, down, down, down into the land from which he thought there was going to be no return. Verse 7, suddenly he says, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to thee into the holy temple, and God saved him. And now he is offering this prayer of thanksgiving and worship to God for saving him. He says in verse 8 that people who worship idols forsake their true loyalty, but with a voice of thanksgiving I will sacrifice to thee. What I have vowed I will pay. Deliverance belongs to the Lord. Whereupon the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited out Jonah upon the dry land. Now we find in chapter 3 that the word of the Lord again came to Jonah and said, go to Nineveh. You've got to go to the capital of Assyria and preach to them, warn them of the coming judgment, turn them from their ways. God was preserving Assyria because Assyria was to be the rod of his anger later on to punish Israel for its sins. God had his purposes. Jonah may not have known those purposes. As far as he was concerned, his job was to go and to take God's message to those people, whether he liked those people or not. Obviously he didn't want to go, because he had already foreseen the great prosperity Israel had, and he would have been very happy to see all the potential enemies pushed back and wiped out. Why should he go and help a nation which is a potential enemy of Israel? That's why he went in the opposite direction. Let them stew in their own juice. That was Jonah's attitude. And if Nineveh falls, all the better. And here's God telling him, saying, no, Jonah, you go and save Nineveh, or I'll save Nineveh, you preach to them, and preserve Assyria alive. And of course, by preserving Assyria, what he was doing was preserving what turned out to be a threat to Israel's own security. Jonah was a Jew at heart, and he was nationalistic, and he loved his country, and he wanted to see the prosperity going on and on and on, and he wasn't too much concerned about the people who lived in that other nation. But he was forced to go. Having learnt the hard way that he must obey God, the second time when God's message came in chapter 3, this time he went. He must have been quite a sight, walking around there. I don't know what people really look like after the gastric juices have been working on them for a while, but it certainly would be enough, I imagine, to put the Sturks up people. And his preaching was very effective, because as he preached, he says, within 40 days, Nineveh is going to be overthrown, and everybody repented in dust and ashes. And in verse 10, it tells us that when God saw what they did and all turned from their evil ways, God repented of the evil which he had said he would do, and he did not do it to them. Sometimes that raises a problem for people. They say, what happened? God prophesied that this judgment would come, and it didn't come. Now, what does that mean? That the prophecy didn't come true? Or was Jonah a false prophet? What is it? But I think we should grasp here, and this is a bit of an aside really, but I think we should always bear in mind that prophecy carries with it an element of condition. In other words, it's all conditional to some extent, or most of it is anyway. In other words, when the prophet says, all these evils are going to befall you, I'm forecasting this is going to happen, it's implied, but of course it won't happen if you repent. Or if the prophet goes and says, all these marvellous things are going to happen to you and the future is going to be glorious and golden, in brackets, provided of course you keep believing. And I think if we understand this, we may not get quite so hung up over some of the things we read in the Bible and we say, oh, that prophecy wasn't fulfilled, or this one hasn't been fulfilled. It may not ever have been intended to be fulfilled. The prophet's announcement was an announcement of warning, of judgment to come, or of blessing to come, as we do when we preach the gospel. We preach judgment and wrath. But of course, if a person accepts Christ, that doesn't happen. Or, of course, we can preach heaven and forgiveness of sins. But if a person rejects Christ, of course, it's not true. And so it was with these people. It's spelt out for us in Jeremiah. I'll just read these verses to you. These are the words of the Lord himself. And he said, O house of Israel, if at any time I declare concerning a nation or a kingdom that I will pluck up and break down and destroy it, and if that nation concerning which I have spoken turns from its evil, I will repent of the evil that I intended to do to it. And if at any time I can declare concerning a nation or a kingdom that I will build and plant it, and if it does evil in my sight, not listening to my voice, then I will repent of the good which I had intended to do to it. That's in Jeremiah chapter 18, verses 7 to 10. Now this is illustrated in the case before us in Nineveh. Jonah went and he preached unequivocally in verse 4, yet 40 days, and Nineveh shall be overthrown. But Nineveh wasn't overthrown, because when you come to verse 10, you find that the people repented. And the Lord, when he saw what they did, how they turned from their evil, God repented of the evil that he had said he would do to them, and he did not do it. So that explains, I trust, that small point that sometimes people find a difficulty. Well, Jonah, having preached his message, had nothing more to do, and so he went out and he sat up on the hill. He was out of a job. He was a hellfire and judgment preacher, and all the people got converted. And when all the people get converted, there's nothing for a hellfire and judgment preacher to do. He's out of a job. So he went up. I can think of other good things he might have done, mind you. He could have given them some teaching or instruction. There's all sorts of things he could have done, but he didn't do any of them. We find that what he did was to go up and sit on a hill and sulk. And he thought he'd wait and see what would happen at the end of the 40-day period. Let's wait and see. Are they going to be destroyed or not? Chapter 4 tells us that Jonah was very displeased. He was very angry, in fact. And in verse 2 he prayed to the Lord and said, I pray thee, Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my country? That's why I made haste to flee to Tarshish, for I knew that thou art a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and repentest of evil. I knew that you were a God of love and forgiveness and grace. I feared you might let them off the hook. And that's why I went somewhere else. Therefore, he says in verse 3, take my life, O Lord. It's better for me to die than to live. And the Lord said to him, Jonah, do you do well to be angry? Jonah went up out of the city and he sat on the east of the city, and he made a little booth, a shelter for himself, and he sat under it in the shade till he should see what would become of the city at the end of the 6 weeks. It was pretty hot up there, and we find that the Lord appointed a plant and made it come up over Jonah that it might be a shade over his head to save him from his discomfort. And Jonah was exceedingly glad because of the plant. But when dawn came up the next day, God appointed a worm that attacked the plant so that it withered. And when the sun rose, God appointed a sultry east wind, and the sun beat upon the head of Jonah so that he was faint. And he asked that he might die and said, it's better for me to die than to live. But God said to Jonah, do you do well to be angry for the plant? And Jonah said, I do well to be angry enough to die. And the Lord said, you pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in a night and perished in a night. And should not I pity Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle? Those last two verses give us the meaning of the book. And the meaning is this. God was giving Jonah an object lesson in mercy and in pity. Jonah pitied the plant. He felt sorry for that plant. He felt sorry for himself, of course. But he was very sorry when the plant was destroyed, because there he was exposed to the sun. And God said, now you feel sorry, don't you, because that plant's been destroyed. And Jonah says, yes, I do. Now he said, you didn't make the plant grow. It just grew up. You got it for nothing. And you're sorry because the plant's been destroyed. Well, why shouldn't I be sorry for all those people in Nineveh? And they're people, they're not plants. 120,000 children or something to start with. And also cattle, which is still more important than plants. Why shouldn't I feel sorry for them? I made them. They're mine. They're made in my image. They're human beings. Can't I feel sorry for them? I will have mercy, said God, on whom I will have mercy. And that was the lesson which Jonah had to learn. God was merciful, and he would have mercy on these people of Nineveh. The same problem was discussed by Paul in the letter to the Romans, where he quoted that verse which I just mentioned. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. Is he God of the Jews only? Is he not also God of the Gentiles? Do you think you have a monopoly on him? The same message which is being brought to Jonah is the message which was being brought to Peter. Remember, Peter saw the great sheet let down, and inside were all the animals, and God said, now rise, Peter, kill and eat. Peter said, not so, Lord, because I wouldn't eat anything that's common or unclean. And God said again, don't you call common or unclean something which I have made and given you. God was again teaching Peter what he was teaching Jonah, that he was not to despise the Gentiles. God would have mercy on whom he would have mercy. Peter was to realize that these non-Jewish people were the recipients of God's mercy just as much as any other people. And so it was with our friend Jonah. The whole book of Jonah is a protest against narrow-minded nationalism, against selfishness. And when you look at the book of Jonah, you find a great contrast between Jonah and the Gentiles. And in fact, the Gentiles come out in a fairly good light compared with Jonah. You find in chapter 1 that they pitied Jonah. When Jonah said, oh, well, I'm at fault, this great storm's come up because I'm here and I've disobeyed the Lord, throw me overboard and it'll all be okay. It says that they didn't do it. They rowed hard to bring the boat to land rather than throw Jonah out. They pitied Jonah, but did Jonah have any pity for them? No, when God said, go and preach to the Ninevites and save them from the coming catastrophe, Jonah went in the opposite direction. They pitied him, but he didn't pity them. You find later on that they repented when they heard God's message. Jonah was stubborn when he got God's message. And yet it should have been the other way around. There was a man who belonged to God's people. And these other people were pagans. They were heathens outside. And yet when the comparison comes, we find that Jonah suffers in comparison with the others. Why? Because he was entirely taken up with the interests of his own particular people, of his own nation. He was all for Israel, and Israelites for the Israelites. That was his motto. He didn't want to see these other people saved. And God had to give him that lesson from the plant. Just as he felt sorry when he saw the plant die, how much more should God feel sorry for all those people in Nineveh? God will have mercy on whom he will have mercy. And that's what Jonah, and that's what we have to learn. There's an awful lot of self-interest of that brand around today. I believe our Western societies in general are full of it. People seem to be taken up with their own nation, with their own way of life. And the interest that there used to be in other lands seems to be on the wane. maybe the events of Vietnam had something to do with it. Everybody seemed to get frightened of getting involved overseas because of the way things turned out there. Maybe that's something to do with it. But I think it's probably even deeper seated than that. I think the thing is that so many people are genuinely selfish, so concerned with the way of life that they have, building up their own country or their own little kingdom within their own suburban street, that there isn't much interest in the regions beyond. Oh, of course, some people will say, well, we do have interest in the regions beyond, but within our own land. Australia, after all, is as heathen as any other country. Well, I guess there's a truth in that too. But once again, we can use this as some sort of an excuse for not having interest in other places. I agree that Australia needs evangelism. Certainly, there's an awful lot of paganism and heathenism around us. But let me assure you, it's far, far worse, and the need is far, far greater in other places. You only have to live in some of these places to see the appalling needs that exist. Just the sheer lack of manpower, of resources, in itself is a challenge to us. It's all right for us, we seem to have everything. I'll just give you an illustration. I heard a missionary talk recently, and she held in her hand the total number of Christian books available in the particular language where she worked, which is quite a big language area in a country in Africa. Now, we take so many things for granted. Every single one of us here, I'm sure, have more books in our homes than she held in one hand, and that was for the whole Christian church in the whole of that country. Things we take for granted, like concordances, Bible helps, daily readings, Bible dictionaries, commentaries, all sorts of Bible helps and study helps, Sunday school material. And yet there are places where the need is appalling. The lack is so great. And yet we still get people saying, oh, but our need here is as great as theirs. They obviously haven't been anywhere else, otherwise they wouldn't say that. And the same with personnel. Now people say, well, there's no need for the missionary in these other countries. We don't need the missionary going over there as the big white father and colonizing the people. Maybe that's true too. Maybe there never was the great need for the big white father who went over and tried to colonize people. But if we in our country, with a proportion of Christians far greater percentage-wise than in these other countries, if we can see the need for other people to come in and help our churches, how much more do those people need help? Every assembly probably draws upon gifts from other churches round about. Evangelists or teachers. We get speakers to come. We get special evangelistic outreach efforts. And we know that within our own group we don't have all the gifts and that we can draw upon the gifts from elsewhere. Now, if in a country where there is such a large proportion of Christians, individual churches see the need for this sort of thing, how much more in other countries where the Christians are hopelessly outnumbered? And even though the churches may be indigenous and may be standing on their own feet, and hopefully they are functioning without a missionary sitting over them, and hopefully they are independent and autonomous, but how much more would they need the same sorts of help? Now, I agree that there are some countries where the doors are closing, but there are many countries where the doors are wide open, and yet it goes begging, the opportunity goes begging, simply because people don't seem to be interested. The Jonah attitude seems to be so prevalent among so many people. They just don't seem to be interested. Looking after number one and the vision for elsewhere just seems to be so blurred or totally non-existent. There are other opportunities people have in these countries of going in various governmental jobs, other work opportunities which present themselves. There are many ways in which people can help, but let us not lose the vision. Let us not become selfishly nationalistic, ingrown, thinking only of our own little world and neglecting the regions beyond. I believe there are two very good illustrations in the New Testament parallel to the example of Jonah in the Old Testament. One of them is the story of the elder brother in the prodigal son story. When the prodigal son came home, the father welcomed him, and the elder brother, well, we know he sulked. And he said, I haven't gone wrong at all. And here you're giving this prodigal all your blessings and I am getting none. Now that again is the same sort of attitude, resenting God's mercy going out to others and wanting to preserve the blessings for oneself. The other example I can think of is in Matthew chapter 20, the story of the laborers in the vineyard, where various people went out and worked during the day. and they agreed for so much, and then later on somebody else went out and agreed for so much, and later on somebody else went out and agreed, and they got so much. At the end of the day, the master gave them all their respective amounts. Those who came earlier were resentful that those who came later got the same amount. That was the sort of resentment the Jews had. There were the Jews who had followed God faithfully all through these years. They had kept the commandments, hopefully. They had followed the sacrificial system. They had kept the feasts. And they had been God's people. And now, lo and behold, out of the blue, come these uninitiated Gentiles, raw heathens, and they come in straight into the kingdom like that, without having to toe the Jewish party line, and receiving the full blessings of the gospel without let or hindrance. And they resented it. The same sort of attitude that Jonah had. Is he God of the Jews only? Is he not also God of the Gentiles? Is he God of us only? Is he not God of these others out there? He will have mercy upon whom he will have mercy. And it's our job to take God's message to these people. We may not all be able to go, that's fairly obvious. But we are all responsible in some way to have a part in the spreading of the gospel to those who have never heard it. Let me conclude with three words. Pray, go, send. Jesus said, pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth labourers into the harvest field. Are we obedient to that command of God or not? Are we concerned? Are we really praying that God is going to send people out into these other places? Pray. Secondly, to some people he said, go into all the world and preach this message among all people. He said, make disciples of them, baptize them, teach them all the things I've commanded you. Go. And he said also, I send you. As my Father sent me, so send I you. And his Father sent him into a world which was opposed to God, which rejected God, which you might say didn't deserve God's mercy. But Jesus came. He took the form of a servant, and he came to serve God and to serve his fellow men, and finally to give his life a ransom for us. As my Father sent me, so send I you. As sheep among wolves, he said. Danger, bad reception, maybe get rejected. He didn't promise that it would all be nice and smooth and rosy. He warned them of the dangers ahead. But remember also that he said, I am with you always, even to the end of the age.